Welcome. This is Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, an online Bible study with Dr. Joel S. Baden.
Here we are for more from the book of Numbers. Having done the wilderness complaining traditions last time. The nice thing about those stories is, A, they're all basically in a row in the text. They're all grouped together, but also they all share, as we talked about, a common theme, a common tradition. The tough part about the rest of Numbers is that it really doesn't, for the most part. I often refer to Numbers as like the junk drawer of the Pentateuch. It's like a grab bag. There's all kinds of stuff floating around, seemingly random material that makes up the rest of this book, which is, I think, one of the reasons that people find it so hard to engage with. It starts with the census, and then we learn about the Levites, and we get some laws, and then we get a bunch of other narratives, not just the wilderness wandering or wilderness complaint ones. We get laws and more laws. There's more laws after that. Some of the logic sort of makes sense in the order that it's presented to us. Some of it really does seem a little scattershot. Which left me with kind of being in a rough position of trying to figure out, once I did the coherent material in the middle of the book, what was I going to do to make up a second session on Numbers that captured something of it? I could have picked any kinds of things to talk about, I suppose, recognizing that in just two sessions on Numbers, you can't do it all. So I'm skipping water from a rock, and I'm skipping Balaam, even though I love that passage. Instead, I chose to take this session to highlight a selection of laws circling around a central theme. Not that they're thematically collected within the text itself, but they're all on this theme. And if you couldn't tell from the reading, or if you didn't do the reading, that theme is women. And most of the texts that we're reading for today are, I think, relatively obscure. Which I suppose is true of most of the book of Numbers. I should start by saying that obviously women is something of a sensitive topic for the Bible. I don't think the Bible likes to be asked about it. The Bible was, after all, written by men, for men, in ancient Israel. The Bible is patriarchal by nature. As was the society from which it emerged. And we see this all over the place from the Garden of Eden onward. I have often found, however, that the patriarchal nature of the text is frequently most straightforward in those places in the text where it's almost as if they didn't think you'd look there. In these laws that we're going to be reading today, all of these laws, by the way, being from the priestly source, these laws that govern or look to govern family, life, and land. In a certain sense, it's not so unlike contemporary America, right? Where our stories about ourselves might not always be blatantly patriarchal, but our laws, and often the more obscure ones, for sure are. That was my brief attempt at topical commentary. And then there'll be another one later. Okay, I am going in the course of today to jump around the book of Numbers a little bit, rather than just going in the order of the texts as they appear. I want to go from the more obscure to the least obscure, at least as I understand it. Really, it's my opportunity just to keep everybody waiting for the infidelity test that we're going to talk about at the end. So what I want to start with is Numbers 30, which is truly a chapter almost no one ever reads. Why would anyone read this chapter? The topic of the chapter is vows, right? When a man makes a vow to the Lord or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. A basic rule: if you make a vow and you invoke God's name, you're bound by it. I think this is relatively recognizable to us even today, right? So help me God in court is doing basically the same thing. The idea here is God's name is powerful. Whatever you say, you now must do because God's name has attached to your vow. Okay. So that's the basic law. Like, how much more complicated could it possibly be? Like, is this a two-verse chapter? For men, it is no more complicated than that. That is literally all you have to know. Did I say it? Did I invoke God's name? I better do it. That's the whole thing. For women, though, and that's the entire rest of the chapter. So we start with the woman who is young, but she's still living in her father's house. And she makes a vow. And her father hears about the vow. And if he's like, okay, and doesn't say anything, then it all stands. But if he expresses disapproval, right, when he hears of it, then her vow is annulled. He annuls her vows. No reasons are necessary. There are no restrictions on the types of vows he can annul, or how much of it, or how many of them. He simply says no, and she is no longer bound by her vows. Now, you might say, well, I have kids, and they say stupid stuff all the time. And of course it's sensible for a father to be able to cancel his children's vows. They're children. And that's true. But it's not what this says. Fathers are not canceling their children's vows in this law. They are canceling only their daughters' vows. Daughters are thereby distinguished from sons. Now, I do think that it's safe to say that we are not actually talking about like children here, like little kids. The daughter in question here, I think, is old enough to be married, as we'll see in a moment. But like, actually, that makes it worse. Here is a young woman old enough to be married, but who does not control her own words, her own will. The next scenario in this law is that her father does let her vow stand, right? So she's taken a vow in her father's house. He hasn't said anything to her. Her vow stands, but then she gets married and her vow is still in force. And lo and behold, now her husband can cancel her vow, even though her father had allowed it. She has, in effect, changed hands from one dominant male to another. Though she has indeed changed houses, right? She's left the house of her childhood and she's gone on to the house of her adult life. She's changed houses, but she hasn't changed her status at all, really. She remains under the authority of a man. And this continues to be the case, of course, not just when she first gets married, but as long as she's married. If she takes another vow, like after she's changed households, her husband has the same power that her father did when she lived with him. The text is pretty straightforward about this. Any vow or any binding oath to deny herself, her husband may allow to stand or her husband may nullify. And if there was any doubt at all that all of this has to do with male control over their own households, men's households, we have in the middle of the chapter the exception to these rules about vows. The women for whom a vow is binding like that of a man are those who are divorced or widowed. Right? They alone have the same authority as men, at least in this regard. Right? There is simply no man in their lives to tell them no. So they have some agency in a way that they're married and beparented friends may not, but they're also, as widows and divorcees, extraordinarily socially vulnerable. Right? It's really clear from the rest of the Bible that being divorced and being widowed are not states any woman wanted to live in, right? Even if they suddenly had like authority over their own vows. So I mean, what I want to suggest is that this law, this whole chapter is about vows, right? That's the like nominal topic of the thing. But the law is really about male authority over women. Women who live in a household with a man are always under his control. They lack agency. And remarkably, given what the Bible is, they lack agency even in their own devotion to God. vow is the strongest possible speech. If a man can override a woman's speech, even when it's a vow invoking God's name, you can only imagine what kinds of power men exerted over like regular women's speech. Our next example to move along. The next example, next passage is from Numbers 27. So moving back a little bit. The situation here is that the Israelites are getting ready to enter Canaan and take possession of their land. And each family, each clan, each tribe has its assigned territory. Land, and you'll remember this from when we were back in Leviticus, land is inviolable, right? It's God's land. We're just tenants on it. So when God determines who lives where, it has to stay that way, basically forever. This is the point of the law of the Jubilee, right? After 50 years, no matter how the land has been passed around in the meantime, it all reverts back to the way God wanted it. We also know, to add to the background here, that inheritance of property and land goes from father to son. You think about the story of of Isaac with Jacob and Esau, right, fighting over the inheritance. You couldn't really have a decent patriarchy without patrilineal inheritance. So that's the background. Here's the deal. This one guy named Zelophehad, and I would, if we were in a classroom, I'd say, now everyone say it with me, Zelophehad. It's like the most mellifluous Hebrew name, and even if it looks and sounds ridiculous. So Zelophehad, okay. It turns out this guy died in the wilderness. As of course, the whole generation died in the wilderness or dies in the wilderness. And in theory, of course, his sons should inherit the land that he has been assigned, right? Like in Canaan. But he doesn't have any sons, right? He just has five daughters, right? And I don't know, for those of us, it's not even me, but for people of a certain generation, right? The Zelophehad and his five daughters, all I hear is, I have five daughters. That's Fiddler on the Roof for the non-Jews. He's got five daughters, no sons. And they are concerned. With no sons to inherit, does Zelophehad's property just, disappear? What happens to it? Does it get absorbed by some other tribe? And this is a question for which Moses actually has no answer. So he brings the case before God, inquiring of God directly. And the answer is, perhaps given the patriarchy, somewhat surprising. You know what? These five women are right. And the daughters of Zelophehad do indeed get their father's hereditary landholding. And what's more, we're presented, given this like case example, let's lay out the formal rules of inheritance. The order goes, first it passes to sons, if no sons, then to daughters, if no daughters, then to the man's brothers, if no brothers, then to the man's uncles, and if the man has none of these things, it goes to the nearest relative within his clan. Remembering, the concern, again, is to keep the land in the family as much as possible. Now, I think we should admit that for a patriarchal society, this is pretty cool, right? Yes, sons inherit first, but then it goes to daughters, right? I mean, I do think that's sort of revolutionary. You can imagine, certainly, I think, a world in which if the man had no sons, it went directly to his brothers, right? That would be perfectly logical and almost expected. So, a solid half a thumbs up for this law. This, semi-satisfactory feeling lasts for all of nine chapters. Because the very last chapter of Numbers, chapter 36, comes back to the case of the daughters of Zelophehad, with a reminder to all of us that the rules of the patriarchy are deep and strong and unavoidable. So what's the situation? Some of Zelophehad's kinsmen come to Moses with a new concern. And they're like, look, God commanded you, Moses, to give the land for inheritance by lot, right? That is, God's decided where everybody lives, and also commanded to give the inheritance of Tzlevachad to his daughters. Okay, but since it's the case that when women marry, all of their possessions transfer to their husband, then when Tzlevachad's daughters marry, their land, right, our tribe's divinely given inheritance, will pass to whomever they marry. So what happens if they marry men from outside our tribe? What if they married a bunch of, Issachar guys? Suddenly we're down a plot of land that was supposed to be ours, given by God. But it's bad for us. We lost land, but it's also going against the divine will. The answer, of course, in this case, I think not surprisingly at all, is, they're right. The daughters of Tzlevachad have to marry within their own tribe. That's just the land thing overrides free will, or free choice at least. They have to marry within their own tribe. Just like I did before, we're going to make it a whole rule. Every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of Israel will marry someone from within her own tribe so that the Israelites can continue to possess their ancestral inheritance. And again, the concern is that no inheritance pass from one tribe to another tribe. So in other words, with the freedom to inherit that was granted in Numbers 27, with that freedom also comes a restriction, right? A different sort of restricting of these women's agency. And at the end of this story, and at the end of the book of Numbers, this is the end, the daughters of Tzlevachad do indeed marry, and of course, within their own tribe, just as they're supposed to. What's maybe not instantly apparent is that, like, all the good we felt in Numbers 27, right? The entire notion of women inheriting their father's land and how great that is, that the whole thing is basically entirely theoretical. Yes, the land goes to his daughters, but his daughters have to go right back to men, right? It's really just replicating the passage from under the father's authority to under the husband's authority all over again, not with vows this time, but rather with land ownership. The daughters of Tzlevachad get to inherit their father's promised property in Canaan. But they get married here in the wilderness before Israel even enters Canaan to take possession of it. So yeah, they inherit the property, but they never actually own it. There's not a single second where they stand on that land in Canaan and control it. They may hold the prospective title to it for these 9 chapters, but it's never theirs. In a sense, the daughters of Tzlevachad are something of a legal middleman or middlewoman, right? They're transferring this property from one man to another. And so for all of the women in the future who are to inherit, about whom this law is given. In other words, even with the daughters of Tzlevachad and their example, the land always really belongs to men. It's just sometimes we need women to help, like, bridge the gap between the men. And now, with spirits high, let's turn to truly one of the more grotesque passages in the entire Bible. Tucked between a law about sacred donations to priests and the law of how to become a Nazirite, whatever the hell that is, between those comes the law of the infidelity test. And here is the setup. A man's wife has cheated on her husband, has gone astray, and broken faith with him, in that a man has had carnal relations with her, unbeknownst to her husband. Okay, a woman has cheated on her husband, and she keeps it secret. She's not about to tell, and there's no witness against her, right? So she's cheated, There's no witnesses, but he's suspicious. Or, and here's the important part, or she hasn't cheated and he's suspicious anyway. The whole test is based on this uncertainty. The husband thinks she's cheated on him, but he has no way to verify it. So how can he find out the truth? Before we get into the ritual to determine whether she's guilty or not, I'm going to ask a question that I think is implicit in the text, which is this. Why is the husband suspicious in the first place? It doesn't say so, but I think the logical answer is that she's pregnant and he doesn't think it's his. Obviously, I'll tell you in a second, it'll come up why I think this is likely. But again, we have seen in a whole bunch of places, in this study, in previous studies, all over the Bible, right, the incredible concern with inheritance and the land belonging to the right people, right? Paternity was of huge consequence. That's why there are laws against adultery. That's why we have all of these family relation laws. But paternity is, without paternity tests, of course, the only way to tell if somebody has cheated or not is like an oath of some sort, right? They have to, as with the vows, right? They have to invoke the God's name, which is powerful and scary. So my suspicion here is that she is pregnant and he is concerned that the child may not be his. Okay, what is the ritual to determine if she's a cheater? It's not actually so far off from perhaps more familiar rituals to determine, like, is a woman a witch? How do you tell if she's a witch? You burn her, and if she dies, she's not a witch. And she, okay, it's not that bad here. But there's a whole category of these kinds of tests in the ancient world that are called water tests, that involve either like putting somebody underwater or into a river and seeing if they float or if they drown. The floating, I admit, might be Monty Python, but it's the same idea. Here we have another water ritual. So what happens here? The priest brings her forward. She stands in the sanctuary. That's what before the Lord means. And the priest takes some water and some dirt from the sanctuary floor, and he mixes them together, which is already gross enough. I think we talked some weeks ago, somebody asked a question like, is there a mechanism for cleaning the floor of the sanctuary with all the blood? And I was like, not in the Bible. So anyway, taking dirt from the floor, gross, and mixing it with this water. And then he says the important words. If no man has lain with you, if you have not gone astray while married to your husband, then be immune from this water of bitterness that induces the spell. If you haven't cheated, you'll be fine. But if you have gone astray while married to your husband and defiled yourself with a man other than your husband, and here he goes ahead and says the thing, may the Lord make you a curse and an imprecation among your people, or an execration, as the Lord causes your thigh to sag and your belly to distend. May this water that induces the spell enter your body, causing the belly to distend and the thigh to sag. What does that stuff at the end mean? That is like clearly the bad part, the punishment. It is, for most readers, a little unclear, in part because it employs euphemism. I will admit this is the JPS translation that I've put up here. The NRSV translation is a little bit clearer, in part because it simply translates the euphemisms into more contemporary language. May this water that brings the curse enter your bowels and make your womb discharge, your uterus drop. Okay, so you have to remember that the word belly, that from the JPS version, can indeed often mean womb, and the word thigh, right, cause your thigh to sag in the other translation. Thigh is a pretty common biblical euphemism for genitals, male, or as here, female. The most famous example of this, while I'm on the topic, being where Abraham has his is sending his slave to go get a wife for his son Isaac, and he makes him swear an oath that he won't rest until he finds a wife. And he says, place your hand under my thigh and take this oath. And there, almost for sure, thigh is a euphemism. Anyway, here too, thigh, a euphemism for female genitals. So what is being threatened here? I think it's pretty clearly miscarriage, right? It'll make your womb discharge. And this is why I think that the woman is pregnant when the husband grows suspicious. Right, because the idea is she's pregnant, and if it's not his child, when she drinks this thing, she's going to miscarry, thereby solving the problem of an inheritance at the very least. And the dropping uterus part of it, perhaps literally a prolapsed uterus, as some commentators have suggested. Whatever it is, it seems to be something that prevents future pregnancies. As it says further on, if she's innocent, she will be able to conceive children, which means that if she's not innocent and the curse befalls her, presumably she will be rendered sterile or infertile. So two parts of this, the getting rid of the pregnancy that is the cause of the consternation right now, and also the prevention of future pregnancies, all of which obviously is terrible. Infertility, if only someone had ever written a book on this, ding. Infertility being a terrible, shameful and much to be avoided fate for women in ancient Israel, as the Bible tells us over and over. Okay. So the test here is the woman hears the spell and she drinks this special dirty water, which I should add is even dirtier because the priest writes the spell on a scroll and then scrapes the ink off the paper into the water along with the dirt from the floor. Like, this is decidedly gross. And it is hard to imagine that it wouldn't make someone sick. But actually, and I think this is worth noting, it probably wouldn't make someone miscarry. In other words, I suspect this is a test that perhaps never really resulted in a guilty verdict. Though I'm actually not sure how much that matters, because I'm not sure that this ever really happened, right? I'm not really talking here about something that might, like, would this actually work? Like, no one is doing this in real life. And certainly no one's been doing this for forever, if it ever was done. What we're talking about here is a text, though, right? A text from the Bible that clearly imagines this potion as potentially efficacious. And in that, it is actually just as bad as if it did work in real life. Because it's not the, like, whether it happened historically in the past at any point that matters, right? It's about this text that is like the Bible, this text that encodes this very clear power imbalance between the man and the woman. This ritual is something that, in theory, a man could make his wife undergo whenever he wants. She might pass the test once, but it doesn't mean she can't be brought back again. Of course, if she's guilty, she gets punished, like socially, but also bodily, right? Like in her actual person, right? She is like, her body is changed. And if she's not guilty, right? If her husband makes her go through all of this stuff, all these terrible things, right? He brings suspicion down on her. He brings her to this ritual at the sanctuary where the priest is now going to be suspicious. She has to go through all this stuff. And it turns out she's not guilty. Nothing happens to him. It's entirely one-sided. The man shall be free from iniquity. The woman shall bear her iniquity. What's more, it's also entirely one-sided, of course, because while a man can make his wife go through all this if he thinks she's been unfaithful, There is no such ritual the other way. There is no test or ritual for male infidelity. Right? There's no curse. There's no forced sterilization or anything. Right? And I should say, this too is another reason I suspect she has to be pregnant for this law to make, for this ritual to make sense. Right? This is, in fact, something that only a woman can undergo. Right? It has to do with the loss of the pregnancy. And that's what's really at stake. And I will add that the whole ritual hinges on the idea of shame, which so often attaches to women in the Bible. When she stands before the priest, he dishevels her hair, right? Which is, you know, as in so many sort of traditional cultures, the idea that she should have to, another man is touching her hair and messing it up somehow, or perhaps it's unclear, perhaps letting it loose or uncovering it, whatever it is, right? There's nothing else like this really in any other ritual I know of where a woman's hair is involved. I think it very clearly speaks to shaming. And of course, the whole idea is that if she is in fact guilty, she will become an execration among her people, right? They'll be like, oh, you really don't want to be like Margaret or whatever her name is, probably not Margaret. But you know, she becomes like a byword, right? A curse, right? Don't be like Margaret who had a miscarriage and who can no longer get pregnant and who, one assumes is divorced in some, pretty soon hereafter. Point is, the ritual is gross, like truly it's disgusting, but it's also terrifying, right? And that surely is part of, if not in fact, most of the point. If it isn't actually efficacious medically, I think it certainly is socially. It's a test and a text meant to scare women into staying faithful, into giving their husbands no reason to doubt their infidelity. If you thought that this could happen to you, even if you didn't do anything, right? Even if your husband is simply suspicious, you have to go through this. Right? That's a real red flag, as they say. This is a text that exerts power. And it does so by invoking the male authority of the husband and the male authority of the priest, and by extension, the male authority of the deity. And while our previous texts treat like an abstract sort of control, a woman says something and the man cancels it. The woman can or can't own inheritance, but the male gets it anyway, right? That sort of control is ideas or ability to do something. Here the control is like physical, tangible. It's in her actual body. Not again to make everything about today's social issues, but this is a biblical text that exerts male control over women, not by denying them the right to abortion, but by forcing it. Right? I have been using the term miscarriage throughout, but that's not really quite right. A miscarriage is something that happens accidentally, right, without intervention. A forced miscarriage, right, or an induced miscarriage, is an abortion. And so there's a reason that some folks, some interpreters, using that term lightly, go to great lengths to say that there is no pregnancy loss in this text. But wishing does not make it so. The text is obviously not meant, we can admit, it's not meant to be a statement about whether abortion is right or wrong. This is the ancient world. There were, we know that people were having abortions. We have medical texts from all across the ancient Near East. This text is not like, well, let me weigh in on the rightness or wrongness of abortion. That's our issue, not theirs. So it's not really about abortion, even as it invokes it, but it is decidedly about control of women's bodies. And in that sense, this text is engaging and participating in the same discourse as we are today. Okay, to sum up, and leave a good amount of time for questions and discussion. To sum up, the Bible emerged from a patriarchal society, right? As the entire ancient world was then, and the ancient Near East no differently. And there are, we have these laws that reflect that patriarchy in ways that are explicit and implicit, direct and indirect. We also have narratives, of course, that invoke the patriarchy, perhaps, you know, again, implicitly or explicitly, whatever. Last week, we just read about, you know, Aaron and Miriam. You know, they both complain and Miriam alone gets punished. But the inherent patriarchy of the Bible, because of the culture that it came out of, isn't a problem like just by itself in isolation. The past was different. We recognize all the time that standards and values change, right? We know, yeah, back then they thought it was okay to own slaves. And we know that that's not the case now, right? It's okay that the past is different. And that we can recognize, yeah, back then, everything, of course, was patriarchal back then. That's just how the world was. So the problem isn't that the Bible itself is patriarchal. The problem is that we invest the Bible with an authority that reinscribes that patriarchy today. Not only do we proclaim this roughly 2,500-year-old text as the source of our contemporary morals, but we also end up creating our society and its social policies on the basis of this text. I will admit, I'm obviously using we rather loosely here, but broadly speaking, I think it's more true than not. And it's certainly the case that the Bible, because of its authoritative status, has grounded social and cultural norms for the past two millennia. We're not just coming to the Bible fresh, right? We don't come to it and be like, oh, let's open this and see what it says, and I'll take some or leave some, right? We're building on or tearing down the interpretations and the assumptions of authority that came before us. It may be that no one is out there really annulling their wife's vows or forcing her to take an infidelity test. Right? But it's not about the precise things. It's the underlying patriarchy, right? Women can't own land. Like that assumption, it's the underlying patriarchy that is so deeply, deeply ingrained. And it's not enough to simply name it when we see it in the Bible, which, to be frank, is totally easy to do. It's very easy to look at the Bible and say, it's old, that's an old stuff, right? Like that's the way the world was back then. That's fine. It's not enough. We also have to name the ways that our society, past and present, has used the Bible to reaffirm and reinforce patriarchal hegemony, to maintain and exert power, right? To oppress and to commit violence. I would venture to say that no text has ever been more responsible for the oppression of women than the Bible. I think we have to recognize that the Bible isn't all pure, good light and truth. It is in many ways, and certainly it has been used in many ways as a bad text, right? As a bad text and badly. And I think part of what I was pointing to today is that it's not always in the famous places where that shows up, but sometimes it's in these obscure, less read passages that I think some of this becomes most apparent.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 5.